From the Spec Network, this is Fragmented, an Android developer podcast where we talk about building good software and becoming better Android developers. I'm Don Felker.
And I'm Kaushik Gopal.
Welcome to the show.
In this episode of Fragmented, Don and I decompress. I had the pleasure of attending KotlinConf 2017, JetBrains' very first conference dealing completely just on Kotlin. I have a quick chat after day one with Don, giving him the juicy updates. We talk about how the conference was organized, some of the technical talks I attended, our thoughts on these, some of the folks I had the opportunity to meet. Special thanks also to some of the listeners who were so kind and came up and said hi. It means so much to us. Overall, I had an amazing time at KotlinConf, and if you want to vicariously enjoy, listen to the show.
Today, this episode is sponsored by BuddyBuild. BuddyBuild is a continuous integration, continuous deployment, and user feedback platform built specifically for mobile development teams. Now, gone are the days of retrofitting legacy web infrastructure and constantly maintaining build scripts to meet your mobile dev needs. I don't know about you, but I really don't love maintaining build scripts all the time. You probably don't either. BuddyBuild takes a few minutes to set up and can easily be customized to perfectly match your app's specific build requirements. Now, using BuddyBuild, you can gain back the time that you normally would spend on creating and maintaining your development pipeline. This, of course, will free you up to focus on building the apps that your users will love. Thousands of companies like Slack, Meetup, and Firefox trust BuddyBuild with their mobile development because it's the fastest and most reliable way to build, test, and release their iOS and Android apps. Join the tens of thousands of developers already using BuddyBuild. You can try it for free today at buddybuild.com/fragmented. Did you get a Pixel 2 yet?
Oh, Don. The TLDR to that answer is yes, I did, but I'm not happy about it.
Okay, explain. I want to hear this. This is interesting.
So here's the thing. I'm not sure if you noticed, but if you try to get a Google Pixel 2 or a Pixel 2 in the white color, you can't get the blue because the blue is available only on Verizon, which is what I wanted. Or if you try to get a Pixel 2 XL at the smaller size, the 64 gigs version, both of them are out. Actually, the Google Pixel 2 XL, any of the white versions, I think, are out. And that's fine. You know, that would have been okay. But the thing that really annoys me is when you try, it says, give us your email and we'll get back to you. You can join the waiting list. The problem is there's no time frame for that. So am I waiting like 2 weeks? Am I waiting for a month? Is it 2 months? Is it 6 months? I know this is, I mean, the world is not ending because of this, but it's just sometimes really frustrating. Why don't you just give me a time frame? Eventually what landed up happening is I just got the Pixel 2, the smaller Pixel 2 in black, just the standard version. And so, yeah, that should arrive probably next week.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I haven't ordered it yet. I'm planning to in the next few weeks. I'll probably do something like you. I'm just going to go with either the black or white, the 5-inch one, not the XL. Like I got this. I have a 6P now, and this thing is like putting a brick in my pocket. It's just humongous.
So I
think that's interesting. But you bring up a good point that I think folks here listening to the podcast could also get some learn something from, is if you have an application, a service, maybe you're help running a business or even the marketing department, or even if you're a developer and you're collecting someone's email address for something, it's like, hey, you know, get early access features to the app, or become part of our, you know, recommender or influencer team or whatever, anything like that. Always provide some type of time frame. Like, we'll get back to you in 2 to 4 weeks. Like, that's a range. Like, I know right. It might be 2 to 4 weeks, but otherwise you're left like you are and you don't really know. And it's kind of frustrating as a user.
Yeah. I mean, even if it's like 6 months, I don't care. Just tell me it's 6 months because then I know I need to get the Pixel 2, right? You know what's the worst that could happen is the minute my Pixel 2 comes, like the one I just ordered, I use it for like a couple of weeks and then I get the email saying, oh, you know what? The white one is available. And I'm like,
Are you? Did you get a case with your two?
No, I like to live it a little dangerously, so I usually don't have cases. I used to, with my existing Pixel, the thing is because it's so slippery, I added this thing called a D-brand, which is not a case, but it's almost like a layer that you put, and it almost completely looks like it's part of the case. It's this thin film, so to speak, but the thing is it improves the grip on the phone. And because of that, I've actually been pretty good. And I'm not too, I'm not that big a goofball with my electronic devices. So I haven't dropped it as many times, you know, touch wood. So I usually like to live it pretty dangerously. And I mean, quite honestly, I change my device every 2 years at max, and like every year sometimes, if you know, like this time because of the trade-in program, I decided to upgrade to the Pixel 2. So I try to enjoy the device as much as I can.
Yeah, I wish I could do that, but
do you have a case?
I always have to have a case. I have probably dropped my phone, I mean, not many times, but enough times where, you know, maybe once every few months I'll drop it. Yeah. And then it's one of those ones where it lands and it's face down. And you're like, oh, ooh, gosh, I don't want to pick it up. And then you pick it up and the screen isn't broken. You're like, oh, whew, thank goodness. But yeah. And then, of course, I have kids and kids just, you know, make little mishaps here and there. So I got to buy a case. I don't want to have to buy two of them, you know.
That makes sense. That makes sense. It is funny, though, because we have a whole bunch of listeners from other countries as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember many of them wrote in the last time when we talked about the Pixel, right? They were like, oh, that's great. But, you know, in our country, we don't even have the Pixel coming. It's not even released. And so either they have to wait for someone to go to the US and pick it up or any of the other countries.
Yeah.
And at the time, I sympathized with them, but I didn't think of it as that big a problem. I didn't empathize with them necessarily, right? And now I really do. I just try to imagine, well, here I am complaining about not getting the Pixel 2, the specific version of the Pixel 2 that I'm looking for. And there are people who can't even get access to the Pixel 2. So it gave me a little more perspective. You know, empathy is a good thing. So
it is. And this relates to a conversation I had with one of my daughter's friend's parents. And they have iPhones that they can go to Android. They're like, what Android phone should we get? And I said, well, I always recommend like Google sanctioned devices. So before it was the Nexus, now it's the Pixels. So yeah, she get a Pixel, and she looks at me like I got three heads. She's like, "Oh, what?
Oh, wow!"
And then she's like, "What about the Samsung?" You know, and that made me realize that like traditional consumers just know what's kind of been promoted, and that's been the Samsungs. And I had to explain to her, like, hey, here's the Pixel 2. And then I thought about it myself. I'm like, wow, like. A lot of these folks don't even really know what they're missing, because I won't use any other device other than a Nexus or a Pixel, right? Because the experience is so much better.
Mm-hmm.
Yet most people don't ever know about it. And I would be, just like you, very upset if I could not get my hands on one. So we live in a good world of opportunity, I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And it makes sense, though, because I mean, we love to hate on Samsung, but if you look at it, their the display, like, you know, I think, what is it? The S8, G8, GS8, one of the newest ones, that display, yeah, does look pretty good. Like, you know, as if I'm trying to be objective here and like all my developer hate and biases don't take over, the Samsung display is pretty good. And that is the first thing that most people see when they go to a shop, right? So it makes sense that it is appealing. But if you're listening to this and you have friends, please, no Samsung.
Exactly. I heard a lot of good things about the Samsung S8, which is actually amazing. But anyway, enough hardware talk. But I'm with you. No Samsung. I heard they changed the color white. I saw it in a tweet somewhere. I forgot where that was. Did you see that?
Oh, yeah. It was Amanda. I think Amanda posted the tweet.
Was it Amanda?
Okay. Yeah, it was Amanda. Yeah, I remember.
Where it wasn't white, it was like an actual off gray color. And you're just, yeah, like, are you kidding me?
I know.
What? After seeing this thing pop up from, I got the link here. It is it's from Amanda,
mm-hmm,
Amanda B. Hill, and so we'll share the link in the show notes there. But she shows a screenshot of where of the white difference. But the moral of the story here is don't rely on Android resources, unfortunately, and you have to rely on your own colors. So not a big deal. Just kind of one of the things you got to be aware of.
Yeah. Experience, right? You picked it up. So.
Right, exactly. So I hear you're at, you went to Kotlin Conf yesterday. How was it?
It was amazing. It was a lot of fun. It's day one. And actually, right after this show, I'm going to head on to the day two. So this is the very first conference that I think JetBrains is, you know, completely taking care of or, mm-hmm, conducting. It's at Pier 27, so the location is a beautiful location, you know. It's like this glass housing sort of place.
Oh, nice.
And you get a view right into the bay. So it's
looking at a picture of it. That's a gorgeous looking building.
It is gorgeous. And we'll make sure to add a link there. So the only problem is there were some things that I think were they didn't take account, and it wasn't necessarily like their fault at all. It was like the venue's fault. For example, I think at one point in the keynote, there was this beeping sound because the carbon monoxide level started to go up. Basically, it was like the building was not equipped to handle that many people, even though technically, you know, everything, like when they mentioned the number of people, because the tickets were limited too. It wasn't like an unlimited number of tickets. And I imagine it was because of that reason. You can't just simply take everyone who's willing to come and then dump them in a building. There are rules and regulations and safety measures. So mild hiccups there. But I think in terms of content, it was great. We got to see Andrei Breslov. He basically the development lead for Kotlin.
Oh, nice.
One reason always to go to conferences is, in market speak, it's networking. But more than networking, mm-hmm. and we have mentioned this time again, even with IO, right? It's just a beautiful opportunity to meet some of these people, right? Mm-hmm. In person, who you've known forever, like online or like through the internet. So it was, I actually got to meet Andrei Breslov, even Eric Meyer of functional programming fame. He's a legend, and he's someone I've always like looked up to just because I've seen some of his work in the early C# days. Then he came up with the whole reactive extensions, which is what RxJava is a part of.
So I got to ask you real quick, was he wearing a tie-dye shirt?
He absolutely was.
Yes.
And that's how you could identify him. And I'll add a link to his Wikipedia page. He has a Wikipedia page, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
And he was so energetic and playful. He works at Facebook now. And he had an incredible story. Folks should have a look at the Wikipedia page. So it was just so much fun. And all our friends and some of the folks that we have been fortunate enough to have on the show, all our friends, you know, all mm-hmm. the folks. So it was a lot of fun catching up again. There was this element of a conference being a new thing. It was a new thing. It wasn't an IO where part of it was known or we expected.
Yeah.
It was just like this completely fresh experience. So all of us
no one knew what to expect. It's kind of like, what's happening next? What's this going to be like? So everyone's just kind of excited.
Yeah. So obviously our friend Hadi Hariri was there. It was always fun to see him, the very charming Hadi.
Yeah. So for folks that are that don't know, Hadi does host a podcast. I think it's called Talking Kotlin.
Talking Kotlin.
We'll link that in the show notes. So lots of good stuff from Hadi.
Oh, yeah.
So you were speaking of Amanda. We just spoke of her regarding the Samsung snafu with the color.
Right.
I saw a tweet that came out, I think it was yesterday or today or something like that, that said that she posted a link to her slides. And she said, if you were kicked out of my talk, still can't believe that actually happened. Here are my slides. And then KotlinConf actually replied right back to her, said, apologies, the San Francisco Fire Marshal requires us to keep the aisles clear.
Right.
Your KotlinConf recording will be posted online soon. So that's awesome that it was so full that they unfortunately had to get people out of the way because of fire regulations. But again, kudos to KotlinConf for letting everyone know and keeping everyone safe.
Her talk was amazing. It was definitely one of my favorite talks yesterday. Amanda is a fun personality. She's been on the show, and all the talks are being recorded at a Kotlin conference. And so when the talks come out, everyone should definitely have a look. She talked about the view state machine and managing reactive state. Basically, it's a very interesting topic these days. And she gave a fantastic talk. It was a lot of fun. And in typical Amanda fashion, it was like playful, it was fun, and at the same time, it was it sort of summarized the important points really well. So we'll add a link to the slides, which I think she has. But when the talk comes out, folks should definitely go and watch that talk.
One of the things that I would like to bring up just before we kind of hop into some of these talks immediately mm-hmm. is if you go look at kotlinconf.com/speakers, if you look at the list of speakers, great, fantastic list. Mm-hmm. But one thing that's really fantastic is the amount of women speakers and the diversity that they have inside of the speaker list. So this is the first conference for Kotlin that has been thrown by JetBrains. A lot of other conferences got a lot of flack over the last couple of years for not having some diversity and so forth. So kudos to JetBrains and the KotlinConf crew. Good job on setting up a solid speaker list that's very diverse.
Oh, absolutely. They've done a fantastic job. And I hope this is something that they'll continue to do, which I'm hoping they will. So I wanted to quickly touch on some of the talks that I went to.
Let's do it.
So the keynote, I mentioned the keynote. Then there was Amanda's talk, which is fantastic. Another talk before that that I went to was the one on coroutines.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I was particularly interested in this one because, as both you and I know, we have used RxJava enough. And when coroutines came out, the common argument was, well, I kind of know how to work with RxJava pretty well at this point. So is there a benefit to coroutines? More often than not, the answer is probably not. I don't think there's necessarily something that you can do with coroutines that you can't with RxJava, other than, of course, API simplicity, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
But I was curious because I was like, hey, I'm at this conference. This is a great talk by one of the folks at JetBrains. So I thought, why not? Let me just like see what's up. And I thought it was really well done. The talk was well done. They took really simple examples. And what I liked about the talk particularly was they explained the evolution of how this worked, because C# for the longest time had a very similar API. So they were like, oh,
yep,
this is what we know of C#. They set sort of the, you know, the yardstick for how this is to be implemented. Then they progressed into, oh, but we thought we could do this a little better. And so we added this API. And then they mentioned one of like the whole paradigm shifts was they want to be able to sequentially write your code, but have it potentially be executed concurrently.
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious, because you've worked with Kotlin for some time, right? And I started off by saying, oh, we both work with RxJava, so like we've never had to look at it. But I'm curious, I did assume that. Did you, what are your thoughts on coroutines? Do you think that's something you'll look into versus RxJava? Because I know you're very familiar with RxJava. So what are your thoughts on that?
Coroutines is something that's interesting to me, and I'm glad that you asked. And I think one of the other questions that a lot of listeners may have and probably have had for a while now is, why is JetBrains so obsessed and consumed with C#? Why do they know so much about C#? And for those that don't know, again, JetBrains created the IntelliJ IDE, but they've also been very active in .NET for a very long time. They created the ReSharper plugin, which was a productivity plugin for Visual Studio, which I was a very heavy user of. So they helped optimize your code. I mean, this is back in early 2000s, and I think ReSharper still produced. They just recently released the Rider IDE. It's the first cross-platform .NET IDE. So these things, the JetBrains team has a very close handle on how the language works. They need to know the internals so they can optimize for it inside of the IDE. So that's one of the reasons why I think Kotlin is heavily influenced from C#, is because they've seen all of the parts of C# that's beautiful, and they've done a really great job to implement those. Now, to get to coroutines, if we go back to .NET, we start talking about the async calls and all the different types of stuff you can do there. You see coroutines is very similarly influenced by those things. I haven't done a ton of work inside of them. I've only done reading. I haven't actually written any code regards to coroutines.
Got it.
But I do find them very interesting. And I am going to look into them because they are a, you know, almost like first class citizen of the language, right? Almost.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has a lot of value to it, because if I can just learn how to use these things correctly and use them to my advantage, I may not need to rely on a third party library, be it RxJava, be it whatever it is at that time, because again, third party libraries, they come and they go. And sure, we don't think RxJava is going to go away, but let's be honest, there's one main maintainer on RxJava. I think, if I'm correct me if I'm wrong in the comments or replies, please, anybody. But there are other people, but there's one main maintainer. And I think having something at the language level is very important. But if it's going to work long term, I'm not sure. I haven't really played with it. Have you done any coding with it, or has it just been kind of experimental too?
Same thing. The funny thing with coroutines initially is I feel my mind is so trained towards thinking in the way RxJava works. I never could find examples for coroutines where it was like, hey, all I want is, you know, load this image or execute this network request. What is the simplest version of executing this thing either in parallel or like in a different thread look like? I never could find examples. Everyone dove in to the specifics and like the details. And as you know, usually I like to pick up things with simple examples. And then once I have a sort of overarching idea of how the thing works, then I like to dive into the details and then find out the nuances of the implementation. The funny thing is, at least for the most part, the resources available for coroutines all have dove in straight into the details. And maybe I'm not there yet. But this talk was really good, because this talk gradually did say that, right? It started off with a very basic, let's load an image, you know, let's do this on the UI thread. Well, that's bad. We shouldn't be doing that. How about we move it to the background? And then they talked about how coroutines are actually lightweight threads. And so it's not the same. Uh-huh. It's similar, but it's not the same because it actually is lightweight. And it won't, like, you don't, if you try to spawn like 5,000 threads, you're going to take down your machine for your process, right? But they mentioned how coroutines actually sort of sidesteps that. And there were interesting nuances. Obviously, I'm sure one of these days we'll have like a talk just on coroutines, or, you know, we'll have an episode discussing the nuances of coroutines. But I thought it was like pretty fantastic. And like you said, I do think it's important for us to never be married to a specific technology. If it truly does work better, if it is a simpler API, then it's on us to make sure that we use it so folks who have to achieve the same things have a simpler option and they don't necessarily have to, you know, go through the learning curve. So maybe a new project or a side project. I'm definitely thinking about coroutines way more seriously now than I had before.
Yeah, I agree. I think you bring up something very important that a lot of folks do when they're writing these blog posts or anything like that. And they try to teach something. They say, hey, we're going to do MVVM with live data, architecture components in room mixed in with RX Java and retrofit to with a touch of blah, blah, blah. There's so much going on just in the title. It's overwhelming.
Yeah.
Like, show me the coroutines. Show, like you said, show me how to load an image. Show me how to do a network request. Just show me something simple so I can start creating these synapses in my brain. Like, oh, get the aha moments going. Now, one of the folks that does this actually really well for a lot of the Kotlin stuff is Antonio Livia. Forgive me if I said his name wrong. He is the author of the Kotlin Android Developers book, which you can buy from his website. We'll link that there. Mm-hmm. And he has a good blog post on Medium, kind of talking about, hey, here's how we're going to use coroutines. And he just does something by has a suspending function, and then he just prints the result. And so he's just kind of slowly walking through it. And then he hops into like, hey, here's how we could use it if we were using Anko for the UI. And he kind of starts building on it. So I think that's key for people to kind of start seeing these things very easily.
Definitely. I will add that. All right. So that was that talk. The coroutines talk was a lot of fun. Then some of our good friends, Juan, Christina, they had the road to Kotlin Town. There was a couple of other great talks. We'll add a link to the schedule so folks can see the different talks that were coming out of Kotlin Conf. But before that, I had the opportunity to basically just in the lobby as we were standing, we ran into Eric Meyer, me and one of my colleagues.
Nice.
You know, like he was just in the lobby roaming, going to get a coffee. And it was a lot of fun because you don't actually get a chance to like speak to some of these folks. It was a very nice opportunity. And as I was, as we were talking to Eric Meyer, like Andrei Breslov, like walked by. He's the development lead on Kotlin.
Yeah.
As we were walking by, it was so much fun to see because, you know, folks would come by and say hi and like, you know, just introduce themselves to these two folks. And almost every few minutes, one would say, hey, Andrei, like, you know, big fan. Thank you so much for Kotlin. I do have a feature request though.
Goodness.
So we were counting. I was counting 4 feature requests as we just had that conversation. But it was a lot of fun. And, you know, to both of their credit, they took it in like great spirit, and you know they gave really smart explanations as to why they chose a specific decision. And it was a lot of fun for me because I could ask about like their process. Hey, how do you go about these things? I almost had wished that I got my mic recorder there where I could just record those conversations. But maybe, hey, a lesson for next time. But it was a lot of fun. So again, another pitch as to why many folks, like, you know, even if you don't necessarily think that you're going to be able to sit through like every single session, sometimes it's just about meeting people, right? So
it is. It totally is. I agree with that. I was talking to Jorge Costillo over email, and I know that he was giving a talk on, and I told him, hey, I'm not going to be able to make it to Kotlin Conf, but I really wish I could see your talk, or I have to watch the video if it's recorded. Did you go to his talk at all?
I did go to the talk. It was an extremely interesting topic, too. Let me pull the title. Architectures Using Functional Programming Concepts.
Yeah.
So I actually haven't had the pleasure of meeting Jorge or talking to him, you know, in person. But I have read some of his blog posts. He writes some really in-depth functional programming blog posts. We'll make sure to add a link to that as well in the show notes. So I was very interested in this talk, and I thought it was a great talk. It was, let's just say it's hardcore functional programming. You know, this is not like your intro to functional programming. He's not going to talk about, you know, the basics. Which was also interesting because it was a huge crowd. And honestly, it was the very last talk in the day. So I was low on caffeine at that point. So I think towards the end, I maybe zoned out a little, you know, and it just got me thinking because there were so many of these concepts that I had to hold in my head. For example, in addition to like the basic functional programming concepts, which I, at this point, I sort of have a handle on, he also had like some of, I think he's working on like a library with a couple of other super smart folks. And so he combined both of those to demonstrate some examples and explain some functional programming concepts. So I was actually curious. I'd be interested to know like how many folks were able to like, you know, follow every single thing. Because towards the end, I was like, whoa, my mind is blown. Like I need to, you know, watch this recorder talk again and then go through what he said. I don't know if it was like if I was low on caffeine or I just like, you know, need to brush up on more concepts to be able to follow along. But overall, the talk was amazing. It comes up with, he talks about some really interesting problems once you're deep into the functional world. And, you know, he talks about this future that we can all be in where we can really leverage functional programming concepts. So it was a super interesting talk, but it was pretty dense and, you know, it was fascinating.
Yeah, those functional ones really can make your mind melt. I think a lot, you know, I think it's one of those things. It's just like when you learn a design pattern. The first time you learn about the decorator pattern and you see it in action and you just go, whoa, like, it's nothing super complex, but the light bulb mm-hmm. goes off. The same thing for dependency injection. You learn dependency injection and then you see the power of it and then you think, like, oh my goodness, like how was I able to live without this before? This is so productive. And I think the same thing goes for functional programming. You start to learn some of those functions, I mean, the concepts of how things work. And then eventually you get that like aha moment. And then you start to apply those all over the place. And then what you really start to notice too, is because I did some work in F sharp when it first came out, mm-hmm. is you start to see a lot of the functional concepts all over the place. And you don't even know that they're functional. You're just like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm going to pass this lambda in over here and that's going to do this. And it's just really cool stuff.
Just to give folks an idea, I just pulled up his blog here for adding it to the show notes. Some of the topics he goes into is Kotlin dependency injection with reader monad, tail recursion, and how to use it in Kotlin. Kotlin functional programming, does it make sense? Programming one, the monad stack. So if you've never done functional programming, I will say this is a pretty steep entry point. But given that I do have some knowledge of it, I found it fascinating. And it definitely did inspire me to sort of read up a little more on some of these concepts that I've only sort of played around with. I've never actually worked, with deep functional programming languages like Haskell or Scala or something where, you know, you really have to understand the nuances to be able to leverage the language. So I was, I wanted to drop in that note because I thought that was very inspiring. That's something that I'm looking to spend some more time on.
Yeah, I can't wait till that one comes out on video. I'll have to sit down with a couple cups of coffee ready to go to absorb it, you know?
yeah, for sure. In the keynote, Stephanie, I'm forgetting her surname. She's the one who announced Kotlin. I'm going to hate myself for this. But Steph, as most for her folks call her, like, you know, in the Google.
Are you talking about Stephanie Cuthbertson?
Yes, Cuthbertson.
Okay.
She had a few minutes in the keynote for KotlinConf, and she mentioned this figure that I thought was fascinating. She said 17% of all Android projects that they've seen, I think I'm getting the number right, is working with Kotlin now. 17% of all Android projects is massive.
That goes to show what happens when Google blesses something. And that's what I mean by that is Google says, hey, we are going to support this as a first-class language. Like immediately that opens the door up because previously I would go consult for a company and say, hey, this is, let's use Kotlin. And they're like, no, we write in Java because that's what Google has it in. We're not doing Kotlin. That's something completely different. Just like years ago, Scala came out and you could write Android apps with Scala. And like that never went anywhere. And so the folks that wrote it in Scala are kind of like, oh, great, now we got this Android app in Scala. So a lot of the times, like, you can't get anywhere with these third-party languages. And as soon as they supported it, like, it just, the floodgates open. And, you know, and for good reason, though. In my opinion, it's a great language. It makes me happy and makes me productive.
Another thing that I think got released, it wasn't necessarily announced in any official way, but our friend of the show, Jake Wharton, I think he released the Android Kotlin Guide. That's what it's called. I want to get the name right. Yeah, at Android Kotlin Guides. And we'll add a link to that in the show notes. And this is fascinating because I think it's the first official speaking about, you know, Google blessing or adding a stamp of approval. This Android Kotlin Guides essentially is an official Google guide that talks about the style guide for using Kotlin. And Jake, I guess, was instrumental in sort of creating this and coming up with this. So we'll add a link to that. And I thought that was pretty fascinating too.
If for folks that aren't familiar or haven't been paying attention to any news, Jake Wharton does work for Google now.
He released that guide yesterday, coinciding with the conference. And yeah, I mean, there's some really interesting stuff. I'm really excited about this because honestly, in the end, as programmers, we don't necessarily Well, I shouldn't say we don't care. We care a lot, in fact, a little too much. But it's nice to just have this guide that you can say, great, we had this 1 hour discussion about whether we should have tabs or spaces or it should be four or two spaces. But there's this guide. Let's just follow this guide. It solves all problems. Let's move on. You know?
Yeah, I haven't gone. I saw it come out yesterday. We were sending around the internal team at my client and we were taking a look at it. And I actually commented in our internal Slack discussion and I said, well, let's, before we go accept anything whole hog, let's actually go in and review it because I have been doing Android for long enough now, coming up on a decade, where Google enough times has said, hey, do this or don't do the, most likely, don't do this, do it this way, and then they go do the opposite. Right. And, you know, or they show you the code. If you were around for early days of Android, you remember all the sample code with the M underscore, the S underscore, or M, you know, for all, you know, module level variables, whatever. And so I came at it with a tinge of apprehension. I'm sure that it's great, especially if Jake worked on it. He has done fantastic work. Like anything, go take a look at it, see if it fits for you. But Kaushik, you said something very important right there is you're gonna have these arguments, these discussions with your teammates or whatever about what's going to work, what's not. These types of things, if they're reasonable, such as like a style guide, can be used to settle those. Like, okay, look, let's agree to disagree, but let's just go ahead and settle on the Google standard. And that's what we'll go with. And there'll be no arguments. We can just look at a doc and say, okay, doesn't follow it. Okay, change it.
You bring up a fantastic point. You know, sometimes you shouldn't just dive in blind. It's good to know what you're getting into, right? And again, these are all human beings. So, you know, it's completely acceptable if they make mistakes. And so it's important to understand that mistakes can be made. And so it's on you to be conscious of that, right? Great point. Great point. We shouldn't just blindly jump into something without knowing what we're getting into.
Yeah. And Google also has a very good Java style guide, actually, too. They have a very good one there, too, which we'll link to as well. So that one I have looked over and is quite good. So we'll link those in the show notes.
Famously, that Google Java Style Guide was the one that eventually most people settled on. The beauty, though, with the Google Java Style Guide is they also had this project called Google Java Format. Essentially, the way this project works is that it automatically formats your Java code according to the style guide. It's called Google Java Format. I'm actually really excited if they come up with, you know, an equivalent Google Kotlin format. I'm sure they're thinking about it. There's also a GitHub issue in the repository. And I would silently, you know, ask people to go and maybe thumbs up that. So, like, you know, they know how much we want this. But yeah, coming up with something like that then makes it even better. Because then you don't even have to worry about it. You can write the code the way you want. And the minute you commit it, and we have like this kind of a setup at Instacart where essentially it runs it through the formatter, changes it according to the style guide and just commits it, right?
Oh, that's cool.
So that way, you know, I can just like, go about, write the code in a way that makes sense to me. But eventually when it gets committed, you don't have to go through a PR and say, hey, can you fix this style? Can you like change the spaces? And you can focus more on the actual business logic or things about improving concepts in your PR reviews, right? So
totally.
That's something I'm excited about too.
Those are the kind of things I was talking with a teammate the other day that when you get on these larger teams and you have some extra cycles or you have an intern that can help you push out some of these things, this super nice that you don't get on smaller teams. And like that's, like you said, it's one of those things where it detects a change or a PR or whatever and then pulls the code and formats it and pushes it back up automatically for you.
Right.
Like those kind of things, while not huge, just make life a lot nicer and happier for developers. So it's awesome.
Absolutely. And in the long term, it actually does save you a whole bunch of time, right? Just think about the time you had to spend like making sure that you corrected it you had it in the right format, and then the time saved by folks having to review your PRs and watching out for these things. It's just, yeah, you know, 2017, the machines should be taking care of this. So. This is actually something that I didn't know before. In one of the places, they mentioned this annotation, this interop annotation called JVM overloads.
Love that thing.
I never knew it existed. You know, that's
it's
so crazy because, and I ran into this case before. Wouldn't it be awesome if in Java, somehow it also understood my default parameters without me having to explicitly write it again or, you know, pass the default parameters every single time? To step back a little, this feature is essentially like, you know, for those who worked in Ruby or, you know, some other languages that have this, when you declare a method or a function, you can provide parameter default values, which means when you invoke that function or call that method, you don't necessarily have to provide every single value all the time, right? If it has like six parameters, well, then you should worry why you have six parameters, but that's a different question. even so, you can provide default values, right? And yeah. In some cases, it doubles up as the builder pattern, so you don't have to have a builder. You can just use this. My biggest gripe with that always was that because we're so aggressive about moving stuff to Kotlin, when I have the default parameters in Kotlin, when I invoke that, say in like an activity that's in Java and I haven't converted yet to Kotlin, I had to like specify each and every single parameter as null or like provide the default value, you know, in a string. And that was kind of frustrating. And for some reason, I never looked to see if this was a solved problem. But when I was going through the style guide, I realized actually it is. All you have to do is slap on the annotation JVM overloads in your Kotlin file. And yeah, it does look a tad bit ugly, but the advantage is that when you are in a Java file, I think internally what it does is it actually writes multiple versions of the method. And essentially, you know, you can call as you would have in Java. It essentially provides the overloading functionality that you had to explicitly manually write, which is amazing. That's so good.
That right there is so huge, because how many times have you had a Java class and you need to have six different ways to call this, like you said, six different parameters, whatever reason, and you have six different overloads, and you're like, okay, well, this time it's gonna be created this way and this way, and then all of a sudden, like, it's just a mess. And with Kotlin, I have one method or one constructor, whatever, and you can do this on a, you can apply the JVM overloads annotation to a method, to a constructor, stuff like that, to a class, you know, those different things. And it would generate all those implementations for you with the default value. So if it's a null, it'd be null. If it's set to, you know, first name is set to Don, it will set that one for that. And then you call that from Java and life is so much easier. There's so much less code to maintain. This goes back to the whole thing where I've been saying that Kotlin is just enjoyable to write in. Like when I found this thing, I first read it, I'm like, what is this thing doing? I looked it up and I just had that whole moment where that GIF where that guy is like putting his hands next to his head and goes, you know, like mind blown.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I was like, oh my goodness. And that was like one of the many times when I thought, like, this is amazing. And then that was amazing. But you go back to, kind of rewind a little bit to the default parameters. That in itself is fantastic. And named parameters, that's one thing I love too.
Oh, yeah.
Is that with these parameters, if you have the variable name, say it's first name and last name and age, and you're building in this customer object, it has a lot of parameters. And sometimes you run into that situation. And in one instance, you need to provide three. And the next instance, you need to provide two. How many times you've been in a Java class and you're building an object, could be in a test, could be anywhere. And it's like new customer, Don, Felger, true, 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 false, true, true, true. You know, like, I have no idea what any of these Boolean values mean.
Yeah.
And so with Kotlin, you can actually provide named parameters and you actually put the name in there. And IntelliJ will do this for you now because it's smart enough and it'll give you that preview. But you can actually type the name directly in there saying, all right, well, this is this value and this one's this value and this one's this value. And then you can actually read it. Oh, okay. Is platinum customer equals true? Okay. You know, is delinquent equals false or something like that? And you can see all these things inside of there, and it makes it much more readable, and I'm not flopping back and forth between two or three files trying to figure out what is this value, is this right? I get confused by different, you know, overloads and everything. So, fantastic.
So I have like this date helper function, which creates just a regular date, but I try to make it a little intelligent in that when I create a date object, sometimes I want to create a date this year, so it's 2017 November, but I want to just change the day, right? So I want, just can you create a 10th of November. So we are recording this on like, you know, the 3rd. Mm-hmm. Can you create 10th of November? If you have to do this in Java, it's not that easy because you got to do date arithmetic, or you got to provide a parameter, or you got to have like a calendar and then provide every single value. So I have this super helpful Kotlin builder function that initializes a date for today, and then any parameter that you override, it replaces it. It's super helpful, and I'll try to see if I can, you know, put something up, you know, in like as a gist or something. It's incredibly helpful. Like, you can, creating dates is such a pleasure now. But this is exactly one of those cases where, you know, if I'm calling this in Java because I didn't have the JVM overloads, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to use this, because then that means I have to provide every single, like, you know, day, minute, year, second, millisecond. And this is a lifesaver. So name parameters, thumbs up.
We could keep going for hours. You know, we could go to extension functions. We could go to, we just keep this whole train going. But, oh, man.
That is true. But anyway, Kotlin, great language. Fun time. Good time to be an Android developer, right?
If I had four hands, I'd give a four thumbs up.
On that happy note, I think we should wind this down. Don, if folks want to find out the interesting Kotlin things, if they want to learn about stuff like JVM overloads, where should they hit you up?
You can find me on Twitter at Don Felker, and I'm starting to blog kind of regularly again, so you can check me out at donfelker.com. So, Kaushik, what about you? How do folks get a hold of you to find your Kotlin magic?
Twitter is usually the best place. That's Kaushik Gopal on Twitter, and I've been doing some of these learning Kotlin fragments, so I usually post them up there. So that's the best way to get a hold of me.
Fantastic. This episode of Fragmented has been brought to you by BuddyBuild. BuddyBuild is a continuous integration and continuous deployment, as well as a user feedback platform built specifically for mobile development teams. It only takes a few minutes to set up, and you can easily customize it to match your application's specific build requirements. BuddyBuild is used by tons of companies. Some of the big ones are Slack, Meetup, and Firefox, etc. and so forth. Join thousands of other developers already using BuddyBuild today by going to fragmentedpodcast.com/BuddyBuild to try it for free. Again, that's fragmentedpodcast.com/BuddyBuild.
Thank you all so much for listening. We will catch you in the next episode.
See ya.